From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. On January 17th, 1973, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Brenda Feigin walked into the United States Supreme Court. They were co-counsel in the case of Frontiero versus Richardson, a case in which a female member of the United States Air Force argued that she had the right to equal family benefits as the male airman she served with. Brenda Feigin remembers.
Walking into the Supreme Court was just the most extraordinary but also terrifying. I mean, just all marble busts of old men from years gone by. And we sat down at the counsel table and heard the oye, oye, oye. And then it was time for the argument.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg stood up. And before a bank of nine male Supreme Court justices, Ginsburg argued that that very court had a noble history of expanding equal protection to growing classes of Americans, and that it was time to expand equal rights to women.
In asking the court to declare sex a suspect criterion, amicus urges a position forcibly stated in 1837 by Sarah Grimke, noted abolitionist, an advocate of equal rights for men and women. She spoke, not elegantly, but with unmistakable clarity. She said, "I ask no favor for my sex. All I ask of our brethren is that they take their feet off our necks."
Brenda Feigin says, sitting at the counsel's table, she knew history was in the making.
I have never in my life heard anything like that, nor had the justices, by the way. They sat there, they were mesmerized. They didn't say a single word, not a single question.
Well, Kathleen Paradis was director of the Women's Rights Project at the ACLU from 1975 to 1979, and she worked closely with Ruth Bader Ginsburg on a slate of gender discrimination cases that the ACLU brought before the Supreme Court in the 1970s, and she joins us now. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Can you first describe to us what Brenda Feigin was saying there a little bit about the Frontiero case, that as she watched later Justice Ginsburg give that argument, that something special was happening? Would you agree?
Yes, I would. That was in 1973, and it was historic. It had its own history. I think that we were all quite hopeful that the case would go that way. The argument had been very carefully planned, and that the movement was going on, so minds were beginning to change. But it was historic, and it laid the groundwork for what went on for the next 10 years.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about the thinking behind, or the strategy that we saw play out in the Frontiero case? I mean, you were contributing to the formation of that strategy. What legal arguments were being made to expand equal protection to women?
Well, it wasn't a strategy that that sprang full-blown out of Ruth's head in 1973. It had its antecedents. She herself, as you probably know, was the victim of gender discrimination. And at the time it was happening to her, she didn't go on the warpath. But over the course of the next 10 or 15 or 20 years, she came to realize that gender equality was actually possible. She spent a year in Sweden, and that experience gave her the understanding that the way things were in America wasn't the way they had to be. She also had the opportunity to do a case in 1970 with her husband, a case before the tax court that involved gender discrimination, but in the context of a tax case, and she won it. That experience in Sweden, teaching women's rights law at Rutgers Law School and winning the Moritz case, those all were antecedents to her developing this understanding that there was a potential arsenal here to argue that the gender discrimination that was so embedded in American law was actually ripe to be challenged and maybe ripe to fall.
Mm.
She understood, though, that she had to take very small and incremental steps. She was aware of the strategy that had been used by Justice Marshall when he was a lawyer and a litigator in race discrimination cases. And she was also a very conservative person herself. The language that she used in Frontiero was a little starker than the language that she typically used. She was that was pretty aggressive for her. She was clear-eyed, but she understood that she had to get the justices on her side to teach them that there was a problem here that they could solve and that they had the tools to both see it and to solve it.
So, Kathleen, let's talk in more detail about exactly that, sort of her careful, cautious chipping away here. And I should say it was the ACLU's Women's Rights Project as a whole that chipped away here, and Ginsburg was key to that. Because there's this whole suite of cases, right? We're talking about Frontiero. Then there was Weinberger v. Weisenfeld and Turner v. the Department of Employment, which we'll talk about in here in just a second. So let's talk about the Weinberger case here for a moment. I want to play a clip of Ruth Bader Ginsburg arguing on behalf of a man who was seeking Social Security benefits to help raise his son after his wife passed away. And this is from 1975. And here is Ginsburg arguing before the court.
Appellee respectfully requests that the judgment below be affirmed, thereby establishing that under this nation's fundamental law, the woman worker's national social insurance is no less valuable to her family than is the social insurance of the working man.
Now, about that careful strategy that you hear in Ginsburg's argument there, Brenda Feigen told us that it was part and parcel of the overall goal here. And here's what Brenda Feigen said.
Those early cases were formative. She was very intent on her double-edged sword theory, which was that if you bring a case that's involving discrimination against men because of their sex, that it would redound to the benefit of women as well. So she called that the double-edged sword. And it is. And it's proven to be absolutely accurate.
So, Kathleen Paradis, tell us more about that.
Well, I want to point out something in that clip that's really important. What Ruth said is that she was arguing to have the opinion below affirmed. That means that the correct decision was reached in the appellate court below the Supreme Court. That tells you that things were beginning to change. It was 1975. The decision below was probably in 74. I can't remember for sure. But things were beginning to change and beginning to open up. So we all understood that we had the wind at our backs, finally, for the first time ever. People call this a case in which she was vindicating the rights of the man. And I agree with what Brenda said, but in a larger frame, we all understood that this was about stereotyping. It was about the value of the account of the woman worker just as much as it was about the right of the man to not get fewer benefits than he would have gotten if he were a woman. So the word stereotyping was one she used often, but the word she used more often was pigeonholing, that people were being pigeonholed into roles that didn't necessarily match who they were. And in Weisenfeld, it was the survivor's benefits for a widower with a child, a very, very sympathetic set of facts. And, you know, I have to say, and I'm not sure if this is said often enough, Ruth understood the value of a story. She was a really good storyteller. She not only worked her butt off to make sure that she knew everything every justice had ever done, and so she could speak to them and answer their question based upon where she knew they were coming from, she also understood that she had to tell a story, and she did tell a story in Weisenfeld. This was a very sympathetic widower with a child. The next case involving a very similar legal challenge was on behalf of a widower who wanted benefits on his wife's account. There wasn't a child involved. Mm-hmm. It was slightly less sympathetic. It was still a really good story because he was a very sweet old man. But Weisenfeld was first, and Weisenfeld involved a man with a little child whose mother had died in childbirth. So the value of the story, the value of taking one little step at a time, was part of her strategy.
Yeah.
And I want to point out to you, and I think this ought to be in the pantheon. Between Frontiero and Weisenfeld, she lost a case. People often point out that she won 5 out of 6. Well, that 6 was actually in 1974, and it was a case that I can't really understand how we lost it, but we did. But nevertheless, she just got up and moved forward, kept working hard and unfolding the strategy. This bump in the road didn't throw her off course.
Well,
so I think that's important.
Well, and so what lesson do you think she learned from losing that case?
I'm not sure if I would say she learned a lesson. She was a very gritty person. I think that what we saw was she just got up and went on. She didn't let it cause her to lose confidence in the strategy. It was a tactic that didn't work, but it didn't affect the wisdom of the strategy. So I think that's what we learned from it. I actually never asked her whether she learned something from it.
Well, I've just got 30 seconds left with you, Kathleen. I'm just wondering sort of what your thoughts are on Justice Ginsburg's passing and what the legal community, what America has lost.
Well, I think the legal community really lost a giant. She didn't set out to change the world, but as she often said, she was the right person in the right place at the right time. She worked hard. She took everything very seriously, and she developed a mission and she pursued it. That's what she always tells young women who ask her, "What should I do?" That's what she told them to do.
Well, Kathleen Paradis is a partner at Outen and Golden. She was director of the Women's Rights Project at the ACLU from 1975 through 1979 and worked closely with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We'll be back with much more. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about how the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg changed America. And we're talking to women in the law about how Justice Ginsburg did exactly that. So let's listen for a moment to a little bit more of what Brenda Feigen told us this weekend. She was co-director with Ginsburg of the ACLU's Women's Rights Project in the 1970s. And when we talked with her yesterday, she told us that during that period of several years in the 70s, as the ACLU brought a whole suite of pivotal cases to the Supreme Court, that Ruth Bader Ginsburg took an interesting tack when arguing before the court's all-male justices.
In subsequent years, I've heard her say that she felt like she was teaching a kindergarten class. She really realized that the justices did not know what we were talking about, and she didn't take anything for granted. So, as obvious as it may seem to us that was pure and outright sex discrimination, she needed to explain why sex discrimination is as bad as race discrimination, this immutable characteristic that we are born with as a gender, and that, blacks are born with a different skin color, and it's just the way we are. And I think that point has resonated with disadvantaged groups throughout the years, the 50 years almost, that we were starting this conversation.
That's Brenda Feigen. She was co-director with Ruth Bader Ginsburg of the Women's Rights Project at the ACLU in the 1970s. Well, joining us now is Nancy Gertner. She is a retired federal judge. She served on the Massachusetts District Court and is a lecturer currently at Harvard Law School and editor of Representative and Dissenting Opinions of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, to be published later this year. Judge Gertner, welcome back to On Point.
Good to be here.
And also with us is Barbara McQuaid. She's a law professor at the University of Michigan, served as U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan from 2015 to 2017, amongst other positions in the Justice Department. Barbara McQuaid, welcome back to you.
Thanks, Magna.
Judge Gertner, you just wrote over the weekend that when you were a young and up-and-coming lawyer, all you wanted to be was be like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Why is that?
She was a model of someone who was going to take fancy lawyer skills and put them at the service of social change. And she was going to put them at the service of social change in an effective way, in a remarkably fine-tuned way. And so it wasn't just going into court and fulminating about social change. It was literally carefully, like a craftsman, trying to figure out how to effect social change using the tools that the Constitution gave us. It's so easy now, after the fact, to say, hey, you know, we all know what she was arguing 20 years ago, but we did not know. The law didn't allow for just the fact that you could generalize about women and stereotype women wasn't enough to justify treating all women alike. The fact that women had physical differences from men wasn't enough to justify discrimination that had nothing to do with those physical differences. And the fact that sometimes laws were intended to protect women wasn't enough to justify their continuation where, in fact, as she described it, they put women not on a pedestal, but in a cage. So the things that we take for granted, she deftly and carefully explained and busted the myths.
Right. So these words, care, incremental, sort of a cautious strategy, they've already, in the course of this program, have come up over and over again. And Barbara McQuaid, those are that very sort of, in fact, pointed but incremental view that Justice Ginsburg had about advancing equality through the law. I mean, she came under criticism in later years from, you know, her very own liberal supporters, did she not?
Yes. You know, I think most of us who have experienced discrimination feel an urgency, and we want to grab the power brokers by the lapels and shake them and say this needs to change now. But I think Justice Ginsburg recognized that the way to effect change, it requires winning hearts and minds, and sometimes that does require an incremental approach. You know, one of the strategies that she used, as Judge Gertner was saying, is she was very selective in choosing her plaintiffs in her cases. She chose men to make the point that discriminatory laws could have adverse impacts on both genders because she thought it might be more persuasive to the male justices. And so these laws intended to benefit women could be just as harmful because they were based on stereotypes and not on actual facts. And so it did require an incremental approach, but she ultimately got the court to recognize that the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause applied to gender discrimination. And by doing that, she was able to not only eradicate these laws that were harming men, but to have a positive impact on women and to create equal opportunity. So she played the long game. Even, you know, in her later years, most often she found herself in the minority filing dissenting opinions. Mm-hmm. But by filing those dissenting opinions, she can shape the law. It was her dissenting opinion in the Ledbetter case regarding equal pay that led to the passage of the Lilly Ledbetter Equal Pay Act. And so I think she took a historical perspective. I might not get change overnight, but if I can take this one step at a time, we can achieve significant change over time.
So, Judge Gertner, I want to dig into this a lot more because I think that measured approach that both of you are talking about, again, with the advantage of hindsight, it's actually something that isn't popularly discussed that much about Justice Ginsburg's legacy here because, for example, her belief in judicial incrementalism is what led her to be rather critical of Roe, is it not?
Right. I mean, she believed that the courts were one player in a larger system of which the legislature and the people were a part. And she wrote like a teacher would. I was really struck in reading all of her cases, which I had to do for the book I'm writing, that she the lessons about gender discrimination in particular and about race discrimination, she kept on describing them over and over again. She would situate, she'd go back over the history of discrimination and talk about the impact of this particular law on women or this particular practice. And it was, you know, as Linda Greenhouse described, pure Ginsburg. The same teaching that she did in the 1970s, she continued in 2020. And the court went along with her.
Well,
the court really went along with her.
So I want to actually just play one moment from one of the early pivotal cases that she heard as a justice of the United States Supreme Court. Barbara, you mentioned this just a minute ago, and that is the VMI, the Virginia Military Institute case, where women petitioned to be admitted to VMI against the Institute's longstanding male-only admissions policy. The women won that case, and Justice Ginsburg delivered the majority opinion.
Estimates about the way most women or most men are will not suffice to deny opportunity to women whose talent and capacity place them outside the average description. As this court said in Mississippi University for Women against Hogan some 14 years ago, state actors may not close entrance gates based on fixed notions concerning the roles and abilities of males and females.
That's Justice Ginsburg reading the VMI majority decision from the bench in 1996. But Judge Gertner, you've written how in that VMI decision, Ginsburg did exactly what you were just talking about actually justifying the majority's decision by focusing on the role of men at the Virginia Military Institute.
Right. One of the things that she talks about in her writings, and again, these are consistent themes, is she was concerned not just with expanding opportunities for women, but she was concerned that men were as constrained by stereotypical roles as women were, that they were trapped in those roles. The VMI decision also, it's such an ironic situation. How could anyone ever be in her situation again? The Hogan decision that she cited was based on the cases she had litigated as a lawyer. So her responsibility for this area of the law is so extraordinary. The case she had litigated as a lawyer are cited by the Supreme Court, and then when she's on the Supreme Court, she cites them. And the VMI case is really the justification for this separate school, militaristic school, was because very few women could qualify for the physical requirements of the school. And her answer was, if one can, that's enough. That's all you need. And that you sort of rigidify sex differences when you say, well, most women can do X or most women can't do X. And in the seeds of every decision, by the way, was part of this larger vision of a world in which men and women were free to play all the roles in society.
Barbara McQuaid, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's so interesting is that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I think her views were shaped very much by her own experiences. She had a mother who was intellectually curious and bright, who never had a chance to go to college and died just before Ruth Bader Ginsburg graduated from high school. She herself, despite being a top graduate from Columbia Law School, was rejected from New York law firms, and even Justice Felix Frankfurter said he would not hire her because he did not want to hire a woman clerk. And so those denials had to shape who she was and had to motivate her to try to change these things. And in fact, when she was introduced by Bill Clinton in the Rose Garden as his nominee to the Supreme Court, she said that she was paying tribute to her mother, in dreaming of a world where women may have opportunities to fulfill all of their dreams based on their talents, and where girls in this world are cherished as much as boys.
Mm. Well, Judge Gertner, I mean, any one of the cases that that Justice Ginsburg wrote the majority opinion on, we could actually delve into in a great deal of detail. Unfortunately, we don't have the time for that. So let's just flip the switch a little bit to, you know, she was later on in her career over the past several years on the High Court, you know, known as the Great Dissenter. Was that a role that she embraced willingly?
No, actually, that's so much so interesting about sort of delving into her life. She thought it was not a good idea for judges to dissent because it, as she described it, undermined the moral authority of the court, that particularly in major cases, they all should speak with one voice. The problem, of course, is that the voice of the court changed. And so, as in the Ledbetter decision, the pay equity decision, she felt compelled to dissent. She felt compelled to dissent as well. She felt compelled to dissent as well in the partial birth abortion case, not only on the merits, but because the judges were paternalistic about women, and because the language of the decision sort of harked back to old-fashioned days. She felt dissent. You know, as the court moved to the right, candidly, she felt it was important to say what was wrong with these decisions, looking to future generations. But that was not a position that she wanted to take or thought was right to take as a general matter.
Right.
She also was very careful in her language. She did not trash her colleagues. She didn't mock the opposing point of view. As I said, she saw herself in a dialogue with her colleagues, with the legislature, with the public.
Well, regarding that dialogue, let's just listen to a little bit of Justice Ginsburg reading her dissent from the bench in 2007 in the Lilly Ledbetter case. Again, that is the equal pay case where Lilly Ledbetter sued Goodyear Tire Company for wild disparities in pay that she found out many years after first hired by Goodyear. And here is Justice Ginsburg's portion of her dissent that she read from the bench.
Title VII was meant to govern real-world employment practices, and that world is what the court ignores today. Pay disparities often occur, as they did in Ledbetter's case, in small increments. Only over time is there strong cause to suspect that discrimination is at work. Comparative pay information is not routinely communicated to employees. Instead, it is often hidden from the employee's view.
That's Justice Ginsburg reading her dissent in the Ledbetter case from the bench in 2007. Now, Barbara McQuaid, of course, what happened after that? Because so pointedly, she and the court said Congress needs to do something about it, is in fact, Congress did. They passed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. So, I mean, is this an effective use of that dialogue that Judge Gertner was talking about?
Absolutely. She brought attention to this issue by dissenting in this case and delivering her dissent verbally and doing it in a respectful way. You know, I think in the world we live in today, there is so often shrill voices of disagreement in social media and cable television and, you know, even on the floor of Congress. But if you want to persuade people using this respectful tone, but pointing out injustices is the most effective way. She said, I've got her quote here, the most effective dissent spells out differences without jeopardizing collegiality or public respect for and confidence in the judiciary. And so she was very cognizant of making sure she was cautious in her language, but also speaking her mind. And, you know, that was the way she thought was most effective for, you know, taking on power. You've got to get people to convince people that their view is incorrect without insulting them. Mm-hmm. Because when you insult people, of course, they become defensive and they want to fight back.
Yeah.
And so I think her strategy was very effective.
So Judge Gertner, I've only got you for about a minute and a half left here, and I want to ask you a question. You wrote this weekend that Justice Ginsburg's influence has to be measured not simply in the decisions she authored, but also in the decisions of her colleagues and lower court judges. I among them, you having served on the federal bench. Tell us more. How was that influence felt in your career?
Well, the notion of sort of deploying the law, not in a dishonest way, not in a contrived way, for the purposes of advancing justice, was just what I tried to do. I wrote lengthy opinions that sort of mirrored the kinds of opinions that she wrote, saying, here's what I'm going to do in this case, and here's why. Here's the setting in which this case comes up. Here's the rationale for it. Here's what I'm trying to do here. In much the same way, I would hope, that Justice Ginsburg did, the law being a teacher as much as a decider.
Well, Nancy Gertner served on the federal bench in Massachusetts. She's also a lecturer at Harvard Law School and editor of the forthcoming Representative and Dissenting Opinions of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Judge Gertner, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Barbara McQuaid, stand by here for just a moment. We're going to talk more about how women in the law are carrying forward Ruth Bader Ginsburg's legacy. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking about the latest developments in the creation of a vaccine for the novel coronavirus. And we want to hear your questions and how you're thinking about vaccine development right now. So we're going to try something a little bit different. We're going to ask you, or I'm asking you right now, to essentially participate in an On Point Mad Lib. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to leave us a voicemail that we might use in tomorrow's show, and we want you to complete this sentence, okay? So here's the sentence. It goes, when there is a coronavirus vaccine, I will blank. So fill that in. I will what? So let us know. It's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are remembering the legacy of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and we're talking to women in the law about how Justice Ginsburg changed America for women and for men. And I'm joined today by Barbara McQuaid. She's a law professor at the University of Michigan. She served as U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan from 2015 to 2017. And joining us now as well is Laura Brill. She served as a law clerk with Justice Ginsburg from 1996 to 1997. She's a founder and director of the Civic Center, a nonprofit that's focusing on high school voter registration and civic engagement. Laura Brill, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, tell us, what was it like to be Justice Ginsburg's clerk?
You know, clerking on the Supreme Court, and especially for Justice Ginsburg, is just the best job that any person coming out of law school and recently graduated can have. The cases are always interesting, and you get to see oral argument on a regular basis. And the justice was so, even then it was soon after she had been appointed, but we all admired her so much, both for the work that had gone into her becoming a justice and for her incredible diligence and passion in the law. And she modeled that for us every day.
And so take us behind the scenes there. I mean, you got to see a side of the court that the rest of Americans simply just do not ever. So how did Justice Ginsburg model those very things?
Yeah, so much of the work of the court is research and writing and editing. And the justice cared about words and cared about the quality of an opinion and the hard work that goes into it in a way that was, that was what where the modeling was. Every word in her opinions was her own. We would prepare draft opinions for her on a regular basis. And, you know, this was in the late 90s, but we did have computers. And but she would literally sometimes cut out with scissors language that we had put on paper for her in a draft opinion and tape it onto a yellow pad where she would write what she really wanted to say in her own words. And, you know, we were lucky if what she, if a couple of people, of sentences that we had written, you know, made it in through that process.
Well, you heard earlier Nancy Gertner and Barbara McQuaid talking about not only the types of legal arguments that Justice Ginsburg made, either in her majority opinion or in her dissents, but the strategies she used to make them, and particularly the strategy of not trying not to alienate anyone involved in the argument. Did you ever have moments with her or any of your fellow clerks where, you know, she would say, well, maybe this language is too strong or that language won't be effective? I mean, how did you see her approach play out and how she formulated her decisions?
Yeah, she cared very much about words and language. And one of the ways that came through was in really trying to fairly present the arguments of the other side. Let's say if she was ruling against a party or if there was a dissent, you know, not misrepresenting anything. And also being careful just not to overstate things and to state things with, you know, great accuracy. I'll say there are a couple of words, specific words that stand out that she liked to use. She would use path marking for a very important new opinion instead of groundbreaking. She liked the word way paver for somebody who had, you know, blazed a new trail. And I think that was part of her using language to draw connections to people and to shine light instead of creating barriers. Mm.
You know, I wonder, she talked about how after Justice Sandra Day O'Connor stepped down from the bench, that there was a very lonely period where she was the only woman on the court for a while until Justice Sotomayor was appointed to the Supreme Court. What do you think she made? I mean, you weren't clerking for her at that time, obviously, but I presume you stayed in touch. And like, what did she really make of the fact that so many decades, four decades practically, after she argued that those suite of historic cases before that very court, that there was still but one woman on the United States Supreme Court?
Yes, I do think, you know, she did talk openly about that feeling of loneliness. And I think part of why she did that was to help other women who may be the only one out there, you know, recognize that what they're experiencing is, you know, happens in all different parts of life. And, you know, she did have a very strong bond with Justice O'Connor. They were, the year I was clerking, they were misidentified and mistaken for one another by the oral advocates on multiple occasions. And to the extent that they got t-shirts made up that said, I'm Sandra, not Ruth, and I'm Ruth, not Sandra. And, you know, they had a very, you know, a very strong bond. And I think she, you know, despite that personal sense of loneliness, I do think she took a lot of pride in seeing the ways in which women had, you know, advanced in the profession and the way her law clerks were working around the country as judges and law professors and involved in public life.
Yeah. Barbara McQuaid, I appreciate you listening along patiently to Laura sort of taking us behind the scenes of the high court there. But your thoughts on the fact that Justice Ginsburg was, again, this first one of two women on the court, then she was on her own, and then thereafter Justice Sotomayor, Justice Kagan came along, but still not even half the people on the court being women.
Yeah, I love hearing Laura's reflections. It's great to hear about the inner workings
Justice Ginsburg's chambers. But yet she once said that during that lonely period when she was the sole woman on the court, she said, you know, for people to come into the courtroom at the Supreme Court and see this row of men and this one tiny little woman sitting there was not a good visual. You know, she once joked when someone asked, well, you know, how many women are enough? When will you be satisfied with the number of women on the court? And she said, when there are nine. You know, I'm sure she was half joking, but, you know, no one ever blanched about nine men until Sandra Day O'Connor in the 1980s. And so, you know, turning that notion on its head. But I think she demonstrated the value of having diverse backgrounds and perspectives on the court. You make better decisions when you represent the viewpoints of all Americans. And, you know, the idea that you have nine or even eight men deciding these issues that affect all of our lives is really just short-sighted. And I think we're coming to a recognition there. The fact that we still have a minority of women justices on the court strikes me as odd and unusual. We now have at least half, if not more than half, of our law school classes made up of women. And so, you know, I don't think we should have a strict quota system in terms of who's on the court, but it strikes me as odd to this day that we don't have at least half the court made up of women. Mm. And I think those perspectives are really important in reaching better decisions.
Yeah. So here's something that I want to dig into a little bit, because I think the diversity of perspectives on the court, very, very important, and not just along the lines of gender. So Laura, let me ask you, I mean, I think that other than Justice Ginsburg and Justice Marshall, I can't actually name, correct me if I'm wrong, but I can't actually name another Supreme Court justice in the past many decades that came up through at legal advocacy for civil rights. I mean, we've got a lot of former prosecutors on the high court, but not that many people who stood before that very court to argue for civil rights for Americans. How much did it matter that that was Justice Ginsburg's legal career prior to being on the court?
Yes, I think it mattered a lot. And I think you're right. Those are the only two. She really, you know, she saw herself as coming up and being part of, situated within a movement. So even, you know, while she was judging, she made a point of writing and speaking about women in the profession, women as judges, and the way that the law has been able to advance for women, and the interplay between social movements and the court. I think that really is what was the grounding for a lot of her sense that the courts should go piece by piece, step by step, and be part of a dialogue with the public.
Well, on that point, I want to listen to a little bit of Justice Ginsburg's dissent in the Shelby v. Holder case in 2013. Of course, that had to do with the Supreme Court essentially gutting key provisions of the Voting Rights Act. And Justice Ginsburg delivered her dissent from the bench. And in this moment, you'll hear her actually praising Congress's previous renewal of the Voting Rights Act.
Justices Breyer, Sotomayor, Kagan, and I are of the view that Congress's decision to renew the Act and keep the coverage formula was an altogether rational means to serve the end of achieving what was once the subject of a dream, the equal citizenship stature of all in our polity, a voice to every voter in our democracy, undiluted by race.
Justice Ginsburg reading her dissent in the Shelby case in 2013. Barbara McQuaid, I wanted to hear from you about this question of having a civil rights lawyer essentially become a Supreme Court justice, and how much that matters in terms of the representation of diversity of views and experiences that you're saying that we need on the court.
Yeah, if you look at the background of the justices on the court, the current composition, Almost all of them have worked in government at some point, usually as prosecutors. With regard to Clarence Thomas, he worked at the Department of Education and led the EEOC. So, you know, representing large institutions of government. And, you know, the work they did was impressive and important. But I agree with you that having a diversity of backgrounds and perspectives is very important to issuing good opinions. Diversity in all forms, representing different walks of life. I also think that the educational diversity has been very much lacking on the court. They are all Ivy Leaguers, and it would be nice to have people who were educated in other parts of the country. Justice Gorsuch is one who is, from Denver, and he's kind of the outlier as the Westerner. But it brought him, I think, a perspective that came into play in an important case involving Native American tribal rights in Oklahoma that was seen as a surprise by some coming from him as a conservative. But I think it was informed by his experience growing up in the West. And so all of those different kinds of diversity, whether it's civil rights work or geographic diversity, diversity of education and experience, all of those things make for better decisions that are more representative of the values of Americans.
Yeah, breaking the Harvard-Yale hegemony on the high court, I think it would be good for all Americans, quite frankly, if I might editorialize there. But Laura Brill, we just got a couple of minutes left. About that Shelby case and the fact that it had to do with something as core to the strength of the America's democracy as voting, can you tell me a little bit more about what you think Justice Ginsburg felt the importance of her dissent was?
Yes, you know, that clip you played, Meghna, was one of the things that really struck me listening to it was the way she is bringing in the voters. And there is an emphasis in the language she's using on the impact that this ruling is going to have on real people. And I think that's what her perspective always had. She always had a sense of the people that were before the court that were part of cases and that would be impacted both by the direct decision and by the implications of the decision. And I think, but you know, in that case, when she was giving that dissent, she was wearing her famous dissent collar. And she used that collar to create, which was a dark kind of heavy adornment to draw attention to the visual attention to the fact that something very serious was going wrong here. And Shelby County was about, you know, whether certain jurisdictions that had, you know, a very bad history of discrimination based on race in voting would have to pre-clear their voting law changes with the Department of Justice. Mm-hmm. And as soon as the court struck down that protection, we have seen a flood of new changes, large and small, that have made it more and more difficult to vote. And I think the justice saw, you know, very clearly that this was going to harm our democracy and harm the real, you know, the people in it.
Well, Barbara McQuaid, I'm going to give you 10 seconds here to see if you can just help us wrap up. What would you say is Ruth Bader Ginsburg's legacy for this country?
That equal justice under law is what America is all about. Don't be distracted by emotions like anger, envy, and resentment. These just zap energy and waste time, she said. We need to fight for these things with urgency. And I think that I feel inspired to carry on her legacy.
Well, Barbara McQuaid, law professor at the University of Michigan, former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, thank you so much.
Thanks, Meghna.
And Laura Brill, law clerk for Justice Ginsburg in 1996 and partner at Kendall, Brill & Kelly, thank you so much. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.